Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. This is Justin Brierley and a really interesting edition of the show today. How on earth did life begin, we'll be asking, and I'll be introducing my guests in a moment's time. This is the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio and around the world via our podcast. You can find more episodes at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you can also find links there to our YouTube channel as well, and today's show available as a video too. If you're not subscribed to the YouTube channel, go and do that, because you'll join thousands of people who are doing that these days and are watching these shows on video as well. You can also, of course, subscribe to our newsletter there. I encourage you to do that if you want early dibs on our next big conversation. That's going to be Tom Holland, the historian, and A.C. Grayling, the atheist philosopher, debating Christianity, history, and human values. So if you want to get that early, we're going to be sending that again to our newsletter subscribers as a very special piece of bonus content before it releases to everyone else. So again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you can click on the newsletter link there, or indeed subscribe from thebigconversation.show. Lots of interesting stuff to tell you about towards the end of today's show. Loads of your feedback that I've been saving up for a little while. But for now, why don't we get straight into today's edition of the show? You're unbelievable. Can chemistry crack the mystery of the origin of life? That's our question today. How on earth did life begin? We're quite literally asking that question on the show. How did inorganic chemicals in the primordial soup of early Earth become living systems, capable ultimately of developing into human intelligence? Three distinguished guests with different perspectives join me on the show today. They're all keen to find an answer to this. Going to be joined by Lee Cronin on the show today. He's Regius Chair of Chemistry at the University of Glasgow. He and his research team have pioneered new chemical experiments seeking to effectively sort of fast forward the conditions on Earth that may have gotten life going. He's going to explain why he believes understanding chemistry is the key to this mystery. Dennis Noble is a noted Oxford biologist who's been critical in some ways of the neo-Darwinian view of evolution. 3 years ago, he organised a conference at the Royal Society exploring new third-way trends in evolution, and he's got an interest in this area. Perry Marshall is the sort of person responsible for bringing this show together today. He's got a background in computer science. He's something of an entrepreneur, and he believes that understanding where biological information came from is the key to the origins problem. He's established a $10 million Evolution 2.0 prize for anyone who can crack the mystery of how life got started. So can we find a purely naturalistic explanation for the start of life? Is there maybe room for a guiding hand beyond merely physical processes? That might come into our conversation. I'd be very interested to hear the perspectives of my three guests on the show today. So welcome along, Lee, Dennis and Perry. Perhaps Perry will begin with you, because you sort of suggested this meeting of minds today. Do you want to tell us firstly about the problem, first of all, the origin of life issue, and about this big cash prize you've organised for anyone who can crack it?
So I went down the rabbit hole of where did life come from about 15 years ago, and I started investigating evolution. And I found that while evolution was an incredibly complex and detailed subject, where did life come from was actually much simpler. And it was simpler in the sense that nobody knows where it came from. There's lots of stories. There's lots of theories. In fact, one time I was listening to an NPR program, and Richard Dawkins was on, and somebody called in on the phone and they said, "So where did life come from?" And Dawkins said, "It was a happy chemical accident." And I listened to that and I thought, did he actually say that? Does he actually believe expect us to believe that that's a scientific theory? And he's a professor of the public understanding of science. And I felt that it was really an anti-scientific answer. And I started reading Origin of Life books, and I was disappointed at the lack of rigor and the willingness to really just kind of go along with a certain amount of fiction. On the other side, I was very sympathetic towards the intelligent design view, and I really embraced that for a while. And I had a great God of the Gaps argument, but over time, I started to feel that if you just said God did it and that settles it, you haven't really settled anything. And you've really damaged science as well, because a scientist can't say, well, God did it, let's put that in a paper and let's go out to lunch. And so what I decided to do was create a technology prize, because these kind of prizes have been very successful in other fields. They brought a huge breakthrough in space flight, for example. And I said, you know, let's put money on this thing and let's get people really trying to solve it. And so at the Royal Society in May, we announced a $10 million prize. It was announced at the Financial Times website, and we've had other media outlets cover it, and we're looking for an answer.
It's fascinating. And Perry, you're the kind of guy who I can just see instigating this kind of a search and putting some money behind it. Dennis, you've endorsed this prize yourself. You're one of the judges, I think, as well. Tell us a little of your background, firstly, and why the Origin of Life issue has become such an object of fascination to you.
Yes, I will start by making a very simple factual observation.
Mm.
I suspect that many of your listeners will think that life depends entirely on DNA.
Mm.
That's one of the molecules that contributes to our genetic inheritance. Now, I'll tell you an interesting fact. If I could take the complete DNA out of one of your cells and I put it into a Petri dish, that's the kind of dish that people use to study bacteria and other little bits and pieces.
Mm.
So we put it there with as many nutrients as you wish. I could keep it for 10,000 years and it would do absolutely zilch.
Mm.
DNA as a molecule is one of the most inert. RNAs, which are formed from the DNA template, they're more interesting.
Mm.
They can actually be catalytic, as the chemist will say.
Mm.
They can actually make two molecules interact with each other faster than they would otherwise do. That's a key. You need that to have any living system, to make things go in a particular kind of way. Now, what that means to me is that it's extremely unlikely, really unbelievable, that DNA was there at the beginning.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why, just incidentally, I think your other guest tonight, Lee Cronin, is on the right track.
Okay.
By not starting with DNA, but starting with what are called polypeptides. These are little molecules connected together called amino acids. Let's not worry too much about the technical language. The key to them is they're very good catalysts if their shape is right. And so I think he's right to start in that way.
Well, I think we'll obviously dig into this as we go along, and I want to sketch out the, you know, the big picture, first of all, for listeners of what's at stake here and why this has obviously foxed so many people up till now. Lee, great to have you on the program today. I should say, when you walked into our studio, you were like, oh, it's a Christian radio station, is it? And if that wasn't made entirely clear in our previous correspondence, I apologize. But I'm taking it you don't have any religious views yourself or faith to speak of in that sense.
No, I mean I'm a scientist. I like evidence, and I like to have discussions where I can have arguments about evidence. That doesn't mean I don't dismiss people who don't argue with evidence, but that's a different system. And
sure.
So,
well, I'm all in favour of evidence too. As a Christian.
So I think you can. I know I have many Christian friends who are brilliant scientists.
Yeah.
being religious doesn't stop you from using evidence. Absolutely. It just means that you have another belief system there as well.
Okay. That maybe not specifically scientific evidence, I suppose.
Sure. I mean, we all have belief systems, whether we declare them or not.
Right.
This is part of our discussion earlier. I mean, I think this whole question is really interesting because, of course, there is a mystery, right? We're kicking things down. And I would like to make a couple of assertions or a couple of comments.
Yeah.
There is an evidence that there was a thing called the Big Bang, right? We can argue about that. And then after that Big Bang, there was stuff in the universe and that energy crystallized, if you like, into hydrogen. Mm. That hydrogen then crystallized into stars, right? Those stars burnt, exploded, and produced carbon. And that carried on. We produced some heavy elements and we have some planets. And those material on those planets turned into biology. I would like to make an assertion. I agree with Perry about the being annoyed, I think, confused by the assertion that life was a happy chemical accident. I can tell you that if we haven't proven it yet, and I think we might have already done this in the lab, to say that the emergence of life in chemistry is inevitable as the emergence of stars in a universe where there's matter. Now, we understand that gravity produces stars. Now we need to understand what is the gravity in chemistry that produces life. And that is partly what I've come here to kind of tell you about today. It's really exciting because we've had some breakthroughs in the last few weeks, actually.
Oh, really?
And I want to push Perry on the criteria for the prize.
Okay, so you think you're in with a chance of this $10 million, do you?
Oh, I think we'll win it if he's willing to give it, right? But that's a discussion we can have, and I'm really excited because, you know, I take my hat off to Perry. He's seen a gap, identified a problem. I'm going to take that prize at face value and try and do my best to win it.
Well, look, we'll get Perry back on about that in a moment's time. Just sketch out the big picture here, because a lot of people assume, maybe they learned this in GCSE biology or something, but, you know, okay, so there was some kind of primordial soup billions of years ago on the surface of Earth, chemicals swimming around, maybe bolts of lightning going off, and somehow something happened and poof, you've got your first sort of very simple cell or something swimming around in the ocean. Okay, that's the my GCSE vague recollection of what might have been explained as how life got here. What's is that view essentially correct or fundamentally wrong? What's the big problem that people have, why they haven't, up till now at least, been able to give a sort of naturalistic scientific explanation for how all those right bits got together to create life?
So a really important... So you're not wrong. Your GCSE chemistry is not too bad at all. But planet Earth wasn't just this magic melting pot of magical chemicals. It's the same planet now, but it's got life on it. And the problem we have with looking for life on Earth right now, the origin of life, is there's already populated by our current biology.
Yes.
So cells emerged and created an ecosystem, and there's DNA and RNA and bacteria all over the planet. And they have terraformed the planet from bacterial mats in the ocean to human beings burning forests, building aeroplanes, runways. So it's very difficult to go back and ask where did life come from when life is polluting. So that's the first point. But the second point, I would say that actually there is nothing magical about the emergence of life. It's really simple. And what we've got to try and do, and I really like, again, coming back to the prize and the idea of where does information come from, universes without life are universes without information. Okay, and I think Perry and I really agree on that point, but I'll let him comment on that in a moment. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to produce a system, a chemical system that produces its own context. Now, I don't like that word, and your listeners are probably like, what do you mean by that? And it's a bit like, what happens is the chemistry is random, okay, until a chance event, and that's not a lucky event. That means an improbable event on a probability distribution. Like if I play cards, I might get a royal flush, but I'd have to calculate how long I have to play randomly.
Yeah.
Once I've got that royal flush doesn't mean to anyone unless I'm playing cards.
Yeah.
But suddenly, if that royal flush itself created the player to recognize royal flush, you have a feedback loop. So actually, when you then remove the need for magic random, it's any random.
Okay.
Any random event gets trapped in a bubble in a rock. Mm-hmm. And that then allows to another random event to be slightly less random because of what's in that rock. Because you've basically, you've taken a coin and you've weighted it, so you get slightly more heads and tails. And then that coin is able to make other coins that are slightly more heads and tails. Before you know it, you're only flicking heads. So what you can do is you can do a model and show how many times do I need that to happen for. I always go from heads and tails evens to always getting heads. And that type of discussion is how we're creating experiments to create life.
And that's what I was going to ask. This is essentially what your experiments are trying to model, kind of flipping that coin however many times until you...
Yeah.
You...
Well, not just that. It's also getting... So what we're showing in the lab is that we can have random chemicals that emerge that make their own code.
Mm.
But then that code is only a code if they can read it. There's no point in, you know, if Dennis starts writing, he's writing in an odd language here I don't recognise, but if suddenly I'm able to start reading that language and I can decode it, we're on to something.
Yeah. How are your experiments different from the Miller-Urey experiments of the 1950s where, you know, they basically put chemicals and put electric currents through them and said, oh, look, we've produced some proteins. And I think that was by and large discredited, if I'm not mistaken.
It's not discredited. It was basically people were saying that the Miller-Urey experiment was like the negative pole of a battery.
Okay.
It was reducing.
Mm-hmm.
And we need a positive pole as well, like a positive. So, and where it's oxidizing. And there's lots of arguments about that. And I think, again, Perry and Dennis are right that there's lots of anthropomorphic kind of, we want to basically make life in our...
Mm.
I would also back Dennis down a bit and say it's even nothing to do with amino acids. What's going on in my lab, and there's one important thing that we're doing, is we're adding history. So all we're doing is Miller-Urey-like experiments, but we're remembering what happened.
Mm-hmm.
All that biology is chemistry with history. Right now, we are forced to use DNA as our tape. Now, what we're doing in the beginning is showing how we can use the soup to remember itself. And that's very inefficient and it loses memories and forgets things, but over time becomes better at remembering. If you're better at remembering, you persist. You don't get erased when a comet hits you or whatever else is going on Earth. And before you know it, you've emerged your own error correction system for your code.
Okay. Before I bring Dennis back in, Perry, what do you want to say to this? Firstly, are you willing to give this money out if the conditions are met? And do you think Lee's getting along the right lines? I mean, he says at the end of the day, it's actually quite a simple problem. It's not as complex as people make out.
Well, the prize money is quite real. And we've got a group of us investors who have signed in blood that, you know, they're going to write big checks. And the net worth of the investor group is actually about $1 billion.
Okay. So this is small fry.
The money
for them.
Is not
great.
A problem.
Yeah.
Really. Our biggest problem is just not getting enough applicants and not getting enough word out there about what we are doing. Now, I like what Lee is doing. Lee, I really enjoyed your paper about pathway assembly, which is where you are recognizing the information as a core entity to the whole process of life. And I like Sarah Walker, of course, which you co-authored that paper with. And just for everybody's benefit, what pathway assembly says is there's a certain minimal set of instructions necessary to assemble chemicals in certain orders and certain sequences. And since biology is the only known source of agency, then if there is a discernible pathway assembly, then therefore there's agency involved. And so Dennis and I have had a lot of conversations about how what this prize really is it's a search for the origin of agency or the ability of a system to act in its own self-interest. And Lee and I met in Santa Fe at a Santa Fe Institute event, and we had a really great conversation. And, you know, I like Lee, when I read your work, I feel like I'm dealing with somebody who doesn't feel the need to excessively fictionalize or romanticize what they're doing. And I really appreciate that.
Dennis, what's your view overall of Lee's project here?
Well, first of all, I like the way he put it, because he started with that very improbable event,
mm-hmm.
a royal flush, I think you called it. And I like that idea because it's not saying that the nature of that arising is completely unbelievable. It's just saying that it has a certain probability.
Mm.
Now, I like the second thing he went on to say, because I would describe what he was then talking about, how you move from extremely low probability to very high probability, possibly getting your heart all the time or your head all the time.
Mm.
I call that harnessing the stochasticity. That's a long phrase. Harnessing is like you harness a horse. It controls it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the big difference between people like me and the neo-Darwinists who propose that there is chance and then just selection by natural selection is that I think the chance is used.
Okay.
And it's used by biological systems. And you can prove that. Our immune systems are doing that now as we talk. If a new invader comes and invades our body, another virus, a bacterium that we haven't met before, what do? We start playing around with the chance down in a particular region of our genome to create the antibody to that invader.
But my understanding, and forgive me, I'm certainly the layperson in this conversation, was that you kind of have to have a DNA or something like that for evolution to begin. You know, you've got to have that in place for mutations and whatever to then be able to play into the system. But you're shaking your head at that, Lee. So what have I got wrong there?
So I think the really interesting thing about evolution and life is we don't know what they are yet, right? We have a little bit. We have a little bit of how they work. So, I mean, we know what evolution is in the context of biology.
Okay.
It's a bit like flight. So before, if you could imagine a world without aeroplanes or helicopters, and you said to somebody, what is flight? They would look at a bird and say, well, that's flight, or a bee, or maybe a hot air balloon. But now flight is, for me, a successful flight is getting on a plane at Heathrow and maybe ending up, say, if I'm going to Arizona and Phoenix, right, on a 747. And flight is defined by machines that can do work to create lift. And so we actually then have a theory for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem we have right now is we don't really have a theory for the emergence of evolution. But we have a theory of evolution that operates when we already have a memory.
Right.
And that memory is basically DNA. And actually evolution doesn't happen in DNA, it happens in cells, in populations. And I think that's something that the population biologists have really taught me. So now I have a population of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
Those molecules are in different states. Those molecules are partitioned in and out of a cell. I make salad dressing a lot in my lab. And in fact, salad dressing is probably the most important thing for the origin of life. That is oil in water.
Okay.
What happens when you shake oil in water? You get bubbles form spontaneously.
Mm.
Some molecules can dissolve in those bubbles in different ways. And each bubble has a different set of molecules in them. And you can fingerprint that using a device.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to what you'd make, maybe test your blood to look at.
Okay.
So if every droplet is different, suddenly you have individuals. If individuals are now interacting in those droplets all bashing around in that salad dressing, they can compete with each other, they can cooperate together, and they can start to record stuff.
But we're still talking at this point about inorganic chemistry, right?
Correct.
So, and I suppose that the thing I'm trying to get my head around is it feels like there's a big difference between a kind of a chemical, which has no sort of teleology, that it just is what it is,
mm-hmm.
and a system which kind of has this trajectory, if
so
you
that
like,
is,
to start replicating. And
so that's a really important point you're making. So for me, teleology is a word I only learned a few months ago, but actually I now know what it means, so I can retort you. So I would say, like, if I design a fork,
yes,
to pick up something, I know it's a fork.
Uh-huh.
But if I observe a fork arising and I look at the pathway assembly of the fork, I'd say, well, actually it's below my threshold, it could have emerged, but an agency built that fork when I can discern a number of features. So what I mean is, chemistry is at the border between ateleological, if that's a word,
okay,
and teleological system.
Okay.
And when the chemistry is able to create it basically is able to affect itself in the future, that then becomes teleological.
Right. It crosses over from inorganic to organic.
Exactly. That's really the exciting discovery we're trying to make. Perry wants to pay for. No, I mean that in a sense, not just my lab, but anyone's lab competing.
Yeah,
he wants to see, and I'm putting this precisely so he can challenge, and Dennis can challenge, that a self-generating system that's teleologically generating objects. And what you're saying is like, oh boy, DNA, we're convinced it evolves, but how did that happen?
Sure.
And I would say, evolution occurs firstly in bubbles,
uh-huh.
right, over the bubble. So you imagine like a massive system, disorganized yeah. chemistry persisting. As that persists over time, it has to compress those features and stop errors creeping in. And what happens over time is polymers get formed. So what is a polymer? Polymer is when two ping pong balls, if you like, are able to come together and rather than bounce off one another, they connect. And then it's two ping pong balls
yeah.
connected together. So you have double the information before and so on. And you get the kind of daisy chaining.
It's extraordinary. And in a way, it sounds like what you're saying, if it's possible for life to arise, it will arise.
Correct.
Effectively. There's life a kind of principle at work by which that's the direction things will go.
Sure.
If the physical conditions are simply possible.
I'm pretty sure by the end of my academic career, if not earlier, we'll show that life... The emergence of life is inevitable as a discovery of exoplanets.
Right. Well, you are a confident man, and I guess you need to be when you're dealing with these kinds of areas. It's a sort of like it's like you believe you've got the theory, and it's gonna and you're gonna well, follow it through.
Yeah, I mean, the only belief system I have, I guess, is the belief that chemistry is not magic. So I'm believing there's yeah. nothing magic in chemistry.
Right, right.
And so I've got to set up those experiments and look at the emergence.
Just before we come back to Dennis, Perry, just. You said, well, this is all about agency ultimately, and information. Do you think that Lee is got this right? That there is this kind of simple principle that if if the conditions are right, life will happen because there's this. I'm not expressing it well here, but there's this that the teleology will kind of kick in as the different. Ways in which it can be expressed kind of a found in all these different combinations. What's your view on that, Barry?
I don't know. I'm open to the possibility that this exists, and I'm open to the possibility that Lee can prove this, and I'd love to see it happen. So far, it appears to me, as far as I can tell, that whatever makes life happen or whatever makes information happen is akin to some other law of physics that we've never understood. And Lee and Sarah's paper talks about that. And Paul Davies and Sarah have done all kinds of work around that issue. And Dennis contributed to a book called From Matter to Life, where they explore that question. And so, like, I'm open to the possibility that Lee can figure this out. And Lee, like, I think... As far as I can tell, if you figure this out, then this is like you're the next Nikola Tesla or Albert Einstein, and this is the next E equals MC squared, because it seems to me that
yeah,
it's something entirely
if,
different than what we currently understand.
I mean, yeah, quite apart from the Evolution 2.0 prize, I think the person who cracks this is open for a Nobel Prize. You know, this is big stuff. We're going to come back in just a short moment to you, Dennis, because I want to get your thoughts on this as well. We're just going to our first break, and we're asking, can chemistry crack the mystery of the origin of life? So delighted to be joined by three people who really know what they're talking about, someone who really doesn't on the show today. But I hope you're enjoying our conversation, and we'll continue in a short moment's time.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's show. I love it when I get to sit down with people who are just experts in their field. And my job is to kind of try and bring it down to the level of the ordinary layperson. And I hope we're doing that for you on the show today as we talk about the origin of life. How on earth did life begin? That's quite literally the question, because at some point life started on Earth. But we're still trying to work out what happened, because it presents a lot of problems. A lot of people have said the probabilities are just so astronomical. It's very hard to see some kind of naturalistic explanation. But Lee Cronin, who joins me on the programme today, says no. understand the chemistry, that's the key, and he's doing the experiments which he says are going to win the Evolution 2.0 $10 million prize that Perry Marshall and Dennis Noble have come in to talk about today. Dennis, you've obviously been working on this yourself on the sidelines to some extent. What's going on? We've heard lots of different words here. Teleology, which essentially means a sort of purposive process.
Indeed, yes.
Agency, which means
same
that there's
thing.
Same sort yeah. of idea. Information, and of course, all the chemical processes as well. So can you frame this in a way that is perhaps helpful for the listener as to what you think is at the centre of this enigma that is the origin of life?
Well, I think I'm going to do that by first using the title of your programme, which I believe is unbelievable.
That's correct.
Now, I'm going to make a very unbelievable statement.
Okay.
At least I think it would be unbelievable both to neo-Darwinists and to most of your listeners, and that is the very existence of DNA requires teleology first.
Okay.
Now, that may seem very strange because many of those who believe the idea that DNA is the centre of life, it's what directs the whole process of producing the organism, which is, I'm afraid, untrue. It's actually a complete cell that is the beginning of life. But let's leave that to one side for a moment. What I mean by DNA requires teleology first, it's an incredible process, the way in which cells handle our DNA. When the DNA is copied to be contributing to two cells and the cell dividing, which is an essential part of the development of the organism, then what you find is that the natural error rate in that copying is very high.
Mm.
It's one in 10,000 of those ping pong balls
right.
I forgot his name.
Lee.
Yes. A very simple name, and I forget it. Anyway, it's one of those ping pong balls, you
yes.
see. And
mm-hmm.
But imagine 10,000 of them, and you get an error. Now, it
right.
may seem very rare, but
that's
we've
actually
got
quite
3
high.
Billion ping pong balls.
So that's
now,
quite a lot of errors.
That
yes.
is over 100,000 errors. No organism would be able to survive that. What does it do? The cell comes along, and it corrects those errors. And from one in 10,000, you get one in 10 billion.
Wow, which is quite a low rate.
It's extremely
yes.
good because most genomes are therefore copied completely faithfully.
Mm.
Now, why do I say that requires teleology first? The cell is a teleological structure. It knows, and I use that word advisedly, it knows how to copy itself. That's what Lee is trying to do in creating the chemical conditions.
But he's taking it back a step to the inorganic.
Indeed so, and I respect that, and I like that, but I'm just establishing first that it cannot be the case that DNA, as we know it today, was there at the beginning. First of all, it's inert.
Mm-hmm.
It needs activating by the rest of the system mm-hmm. to do anything at all.
Yeah.
Second, it has this terrible error rate, which our cells yeah. correct all the
so
time.
So you need the cell for the DNA to be worth
absolutely
doing
so.
Anything.
That's why I say the yeah. DNA requires yeah. teleology first.
And in that sense, if teleology is there to start with, it's almost like, now, as you say, the neo-Darwinists will say you're putting the cart before the
exactly
horse.
Exactly so. Yes, they do.
Because you're introducing something that seems a little bit mystical, almost, at the outset.
Well, I don't think teleology is mystical.
Okay.
But over
but
to Lee,
why then?
He was saying that earlier
You're shaking your head at that, Lee. So,
so
go ahead.
So, I mean, actually, I don't think Dennis's statement is unbelievable at all. In fact, it's entirely amenable to what we're trying to do in the lab.
Uh-huh.
The thing is, this is where the... And I think I really share Perry's frustration looking at the origin of life, reading those books. Everyone's trying to make a soup that magically comes up with DNA, RNA, or assembled proteins. It isn't going to happen because there's an information catastrophe. What... And Perry's alluded to a paper that I've written that talks about a threshold where we're looking for living systems.
Mm.
But what that paper's allowing us to do is make a life emergence detector, which I've made a detection system that allows me to spot flight when I haven't invented a flying plane.
Uh-huh.
The Wright brothers only went a few hundred yards
uh-huh.
in a wooden thing with some bicycle pedals, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going across the ocean in that. And so what I'm trying to find out is the lineage of chemistry that makes the most primitive rubbish machine that isn't a machine, it's a random ensemble, but as soon as that random mess is able to copy itself, and we've actually got one, I'm just publishing it right now, salt that makes itself, a actual table salt that can self-replicate from nothing. Now, you think about that for a second. Not only can self-replicate, but its children are just ever so slightly more complicated than the parents, but not so complicated that they're impossible to get. And that, if you carry on making those templates, if you like, you start to get towards the sophistication of DNA without requiring it to be there.
So what's happening there? Because inevitably we kind of tend to anthropomorphize this salt as though it's, oh, the salt wants to do this and it's going to
exactly,
do that.
Exactly.
And that's unhelpful sometimes,
we need to
look.
And so what I'm trying to get is the emergence of anthropomorphic behavior.
Yes.
In a completely different way. And that's kind of, that's nice, because it's almost like metaphysics squared. So what is like the metaphysics of metaphysics, right? Or the politics of the politics of the B word.
Yeah.
So what I mean is that, so Dennis and Perry are both right that DNA is a ludicrous molecule to expect to spontaneously form.
Uh-huh.
That's not actually good evidence for a creator. It's evidence for other primitive life living systems that no longer exist on Earth. It's a bit like in the lineage of computers. I've been designing computers all my life. But if I was to obliterate all the computers on Earth right now, we'd have a problem, because we need a computer to build a computer. So I would ask, what is the simplest computer I can use to build a slightly more sophisticated computer, build a more sophisticated computer so I can make silicon chips again?
Right.
And I'd get all the way back. And that is exactly what we need to look at with DNA, which is, what is the simplest machine that makes another machine DNA?
So again, my stupid question at the base of all this is when this simple salt molecule effectively reproduces and some of its children become slightly more complex salt molecules, and then the complexity kind of builds. What's the benefit of that happening?
So this is where the new physics comes in, right? We don't, the problem with, if you go back to the Big Bang and I write down the equations of physics, you'd say, you know how the universe would unfold. Yet none of those equations would predict life. And that's really infuriating, probably, to Perry, to Dennis, and myself. And so what we've found is that there is a missing phenomena, which I'll call assembly. And what happens is the universe likes to assemble things. Now, you can see that on Jupiter's spot, right? You can see that in hurricanes. So what the salt is doing is it happens to find a motif that fights against error. Because when the wind blows the sand away, because it's resistant to being blown away, it can make itself, so it can still exist. All life is, it's pretty boring, actually, when you think about it. Life is a complex chemical system that can persist over time. And if you erase it, it's no longer there, and you don't care. So what I'm saying is that salt that can make itself can recruit other salt molecules or salt ions to assemble, and they are now resistant to being erased.
I kind of understand that argument on the biological evolutionary side, because there's a sort of sense in which there's a will almost in even the simplest organisms to reproduce. But
I mean, it's the same phenomena, right? There's a missing physics of information which connects physics and chemistry, and we try and understand the heat death of the universe. And that's a really interesting problem to try and join together. There's a lot for us. But life is not that special.
Okay.
It's just a manifestation of chemistry. I mean, you know, here I'm kind of, not all matter is equal, right? I'm holding a bottle of water. I own that bottle of water. I could destroy the bottle. I could drink the water. This matter's inanimate. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. And so what we're trying to ask is, what makes matter matter?
Yes.
And that's that informational imprint.
It's the... Okay, Perry, what do you want to say to all of this? There's lots I'm sure you'd like to respond to.
Oh, I think the key thing that he said was, there's a missing physics of information. And I am very enthusiastic about somebody who can solve this. And I think this is great. I have to admit to being a little skeptical that Lee has solved it. Totally open that maybe he did. I again think this is akin to like discovering a new law of physics. I think this assembly that he's talking about. Like, he's right on track. And I have to commend Lee for bridging the information and the chemistry worlds together, because so at the Origin of Life meeting at the Santa Fe Institute at Stu Kaufman's house, there's like four or five chemists and three or four physicists and some biologists. And the chemists had a very different view of everything than most of the other people in the room. And it was actually kind of difficult for different parts of the room to talk to each other because they were approaching it so differently. So the fact that you're doing an interdisciplinary bridge between these two fields, I think is great. And I'm not in a position to comment on how successful you've been so far, but I like the work that I've seen.
Okay. So you're hopeful that this might be a new way into the issue and could bear some fruit. I mean, for you, what are the sticking points? Where you can you see it potentially coming unstuck? And maybe, you know, Lee can respond to that. I mean, you've always been, ever since I've known you, Perry, and I know your views have changed over that time, but you've always been about the information and about the fact that you kind of have to have information right at the beginning to be able to have something that kind of makes sense from that point on. You don't kind of, you know, there's no free lunch. You can't get information just spontaneously appear in that kind of way. So talk to me about that issue and how it pertains to this problem and whether Lee has a chance of kind of solving that issue for me, Perry.
Well, so information is abstract and symbolic. So the words in a book are formed from paper and ink, but they are not ink. And in DNA, in the genetic code, GGG is instructions to make glycine. It's not glycine. And there's a symbolic relationship. And nobody knows how to get from chemistry to symbolic relationships. Now, if Lee's got that, like, man, like, you're gonna get a lot more recognition than just getting $10 million. And it's really extraordinary. I have some caution that you're making it sound too easy. But, you know, I don't know what you accomplished in the last few weeks. So I remain willing to be convinced.
Okay. Whatever that salt is, it's not going on any fish and chips anytime soon, I suspect. One thing that I know that you're very concerned about, Dennis, is as we search the stars and the planets for the possibility that life might exist elsewhere, we obviously need to be very careful we don't cross-contaminate with what's already happened.
Lee and I might disagree, but okay. Let's see.
Yes. I mean, what would it mean for you, Dennis, if we did find even the most simple life or the building blocks of life, let's say, elsewhere?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of very important questions that are not yet clear. Mm. First of all, the code itself between the sequence of DNA and sequence of proteins, we know, as Perry's already referred to, that particular triplets code for particular amino acids. Now, an important fact about that code is it's redundant. There are far fewer amino acids than there could be from that code alone. There's only about 20, and you could easily have 32. Now, that means that each of those triplets code, put it the other way around, each of the amino acids can be coded for by more than one triplet. That's the redundancy. Now, does that really have to be there?
Right.
Could there be proteins with more than 20 amino acids? I can't see why not. And if we find life on wherever in the solar system, that's the most likely place we might find it, in addition to Earth, does it have, if it has a code at all, does it have just the 20 amino acids that we know of? Or does it, in fact, have no DNA at all? As I think we're postulating in this discussion, that it's extremely likely that if there are very primitive forms of life, there won't be DNA at all. I would like to know the answer to that question.
Yeah, so if we do, it won't necessarily look like life on Earth necessarily.
That's right.
And you're nodding your head in agreement with that, Lee. So
yeah. Well, I just tell you, so the assembly thing, that paper that Perry was talking about, is really, for me, an important concept. And I want to take 2 seconds, if I may, to tell you about why we need it. So the Large Hadron Collider is arguably been one of the most successful experiments done, not just because of the grandness of the science, but the way it's been communicated. Yeah. So you've got this thing called the Standard Model of the Universe, which we believe is correct, or we say we've got evidence is correct. There's actually some wrinkles in it, but let's just accept that's pretty okay. And that Standard Model says we have to for gravity to exist, there needs to be a particle. And that particle was called the Higgs. So then they took the Standard Model and they then worked that up and did a simulation, if you like, and they worked out at what energy to find it.
Yeah.
So then they devised an experiment. So they know the Standard Model, they know looking at the Higgs, they've got an experiment, and all they did is they looked at that energy range, smashing particles together, and they looked for the Higgs.
And hey presto.
And they found it. Mm. So, we're going to go and look for life, guys. What are we going to find? And then, you know, Perry will say, we want this, and Dennis will say, I want that, and Lee will say, I want... And we like say, right, okay, damn it, we can't actually decide on what life is... So what I've come up with is forgetting what life is, but looking on what life does.
Okay.
So what does life do that's different to a non-living, say, planet? Well, life makes things. Now, it makes really simple things. So it could make carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide from biology and carbon dioxide from inorganic stuff looks the same. But actually, you do something more important. You make complex molecules. You make cars. You make silicon processors. Mm. So if we look for objects that basically can't randomly form, like have a creator, and I don't like using the word creator because then we get into this discussion about intelligent design, but I think actually... I shouldn't be shy about having that discussion because I think
before the end of the show.
Yeah, many of your listeners will say, "Well, hang on. I have a belief system. Yeah. I want to understand why
why
you don't have that discussion exactly."
Okay.
So, but life, living systems tend to make stuff, be it other living systems or artwork. Take a Jackson Pollock. You know a Jackson Pollock when you see one. So, the thing is, if you go to Mars and you found a Jackson Pollock, you'd say, that's a random assemble. Now you say you find three or four objects that look really complicated, but they clearly had the same artist. Mm-hmm. You would know that Jackson Pollock had been to Mars for sure. And so that's what pathway assembly starts to do. It gives you a metric.
Mm-hmm.
It then says there's this thing called life. We don't have a general theory for it, but we know there is this thing it does. Yeah. And now we have a way of going looking for it. And that's what we've been doing in my group.
So if they did go to Mars and find... you know, something that was approximate to that, basically your theory would be confirmed. It's like the Higgs boson kind of confirmed that theory.
What I would say, if you went to Mars and let's put it, and you found 1,000 iPhones,
sure.
And they all turned on and they all worked,
yeah.
you could only conclude that Apple had started making iPhones on Mars.
Which would be completely believable.
Shipping them there. You wouldn't go, oh... these iPhones just randomly assembled on Mars.
No, sure.
So that I think that's what I'm saying.
Okay, all right. Let's come back to you, Dennis. You say that actually you're really interested in the search for extraterrestrial life in that way.
Yes, because I think it would answer some of the big questions of biology today.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, if we went out and say in our solar system and in areas we might have access to, just couldn't find any sign of anything approaching, you know. Would that be strongly disconfirmational of Lee's approach, do you think? Or
not necessarily. We are an extremely tiny part of the universe.
Of course.
Even the whole solar system, even though it's vast in terms of the size of an organism like you and me, it's still a very, very tiny bit of the whole universe. Mm. Now, there is a theory that... some forms of life can go completely dry and survive in space.
Okay.
This is called the panspermia idea.
Mm.
Now, I think this is close as science gets to being unbelievable. but it is a theory that's been seriously held. It was first formulated, as far as I know, by Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, many, many years ago, and one of those who thought a lot about the...
And this would be potentially, some people have put this as an explanation for how life was seeded on Earth, that it came from somewhere else.
That's the idea, yes, indeed. And there is evidence, you see, for that, because some of the meteorites that have come down onto Earth from somewhere up there, we don't know where from, contain organic chemicals, and they can contain up to 70 different amino acids. That's 50 more than we've got on Earth.
I've got a feeling this was the premise of that Ridley Scott movie, wasn't it, where the architects come and birth life or something early on. But go on, Lee,
Just add to that. So we've turned this pathway assembly idea into a life detection system that we're making for NASA. We've also taken all the meteorites and analyze them using this detection system. And yes, you can make lots of amino acids, but they're all able to be made in a random shuffle of the card deck. They're all random molecules. Okay. So although you can find amino acids on meteorites, they've just been cooked up in space. They have never touched life. They've never been anywhere near life. They are not life, but they might be used by life. Bacteria could eat meteorites, no problem.
So you don't think the panspermia thing is a going?
Well, no, I don't. I agree with Dennis that this is almost as unbelievable as they come, but I haven't seen any, and I've certainly seen no evidence for panspermia. However, I won't just shoot it down because it's improbable or impossible because I don't like the idea. I think it's far easier to make life on Earth than transport life from elsewhere in the universe and put it here.
Right.
I think that life might have got going on Mars a little bit of the chemistry search.
Okay.
And then it kicked out that chemistry.
Right.
And because Earth has got a bigger gravitational pull, Mars was in the habitable zone earlier, so we got cooking. So it did the pre-course for you, and chucked it on Earth where it made the main menu.
Okay, that's an interesting theory.
Maybe.
What do you reckon about that, Perry? Do you think? Do you feel in any way like there's a chance we could find life elsewhere? And what would that have to say to your search for the origin of life yourself, Perry?
I don't have a strong opinion about it. I'm probably roughly similar to Dennis on this and Lee. Hey, if this happens to be the case, well, that's very, very interesting. On the other hand, you know, there's a book probably 15 or 20 years old called Where Is Everybody? And it's a book about, well, where are all these aliens that should be so abundantly likely to occur? So I don't have a real strong.
I mean, I had probably going on for 10 years ago now, Paul Davies on my show, and it was around a particular anniversary of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And he'd written a book called The Eerie Silence. And I remember him saying effectively, well, life is, he said life is at one level incredibly improbable, such that either it's only probably developed once here on Earth, or there's some other principle at work whereby if it can arise, it will arise, which kind of sounds like your principle at some level, Lee. But he was also very critical of the typical sort of happy chance coincidence kind of theories. He said that's just not really a viable option. We're going to go to a break just shortly, but... here's a name, and I don't know if any of you have come across this. Probably Perry, you might want to speak to this. Someone who people keep saying I should get on my show to talk about this issue is James Torr, who I believe is a US professor of nanotechnology. And from what I've heard, Lee has put his head in his hands, which I guess suggests with the way he feels about this name. I'm coming to this as a layperson, but I've heard people saying Jim Torr, he's your man because he says he knows his stuff, and he says it just isn't going to happen in a naturalistic fashion. There has to be some kind of design going on, an input of information right at the beginning. All right, before we get to Lee, who looks very... who has had an interesting reaction to that name. Perry, what's your position on Jim Torr and what he's saying in this debate?
Well, I admire anybody in academia who's willing to go against the grain and call a spade and say what he really thinks. Because frankly, I think most scientists are afraid to do so. He's a chemist. I'm an information guy. He and I have had brief conversations. We kind of speak different languages. So, you know, I'll let the chemists duke it out about chemistry. But what I would say is that a lot of origin of life people make it sound as though, well, you know, all we need to do is get a little replicator started and it's all going to go from there. And most of the time they're being dishonest even about the word replicator. Well, if you want to replicate the way a cell does, you have to have symbolic code that stores information about how the organism is supposed to be put together. And that's completely different than RNA strands making copies of each other, which is kind of like crystals forming. And so I got to say, there's a lot of dishonesty in the origin of life field. And James Tour is saying what he thinks. And I at least salute him for doing that. And I'd be interested in hear what Lee has to say about the specifics. In fact, maybe you, Lee and James could have a debate on this show.
Maybe they could. Fantastic. Maybe they could. But I we're going to go to a break for now, and then we'll hear what Lee has to say about James Tour. And we'll come back shortly talking about the origin of life, the mystery of the origin of life, and whether chemistry can crack it. Lee Cronin, Dennis Noble and Perry Marshall are my guests on this week's edition of Unbelievable. Hi, it's Justin again. Occasionally, listeners get in touch to say, I love what you're doing with the show. We need to have more of these conversations. Can I help? Well, the answer is yes. Creating these kinds of conversations obviously takes time and money, and we're producing more and more video, audio, and online content from Unbelievable. So if you'd like to support this work and contribute any amount, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give. And as a thank you, you'll receive my brand new ebook, In Conversation With, featuring some of my favourite chats with people like Jordan Peterson, Tim Keller, Richard Dawkins, Paula Gooder, Darren Brown and Rick Warren. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Welcome back to this week's edition of Unbelievable. With me, Justin Brierley, the third and final part of today's show, looking at the origins of life, and we'll return to our discussion on that very shortly. Also available on video today's show, do go and check out our YouTube channel. You're looking for Unbelievable on YouTube. And loads of people, of course, are getting hold of the latest edition of The Big Conversation there. That was our discussion last week, Dave Rubin and John Lennox. And I've had so much great positive engagement and feedback to that discussion that was recorded live out in California. I'm going to bring some of that next week because I've got loads of other feedback from previous editions of the show that I'd like to bring towards the end of today's discussion. If you can listen straight after today's show, you won't want to miss Mark Sayers. He's an Australian pastor and cultural theologian sitting down with Sam Hales on The Profile. Mark is well known for his podcast, This Cultural Moment, with John Mark Comer. And so do check that out if you can listen after Unbelievable today, or indeed get it via its own podcast. That's The Profile from Premier Christianity that you're looking for. In fact, an Unbelievable listener, Mike Wilson, got in touch to say, listening to the incredibly large back catalogue of Unbelievable and occasionally hearing Justin's encouraging requests for guests, I'm still somewhere in 2011-2012 at the moment. But have you considered having Mark Sayers on an episode of Unbelievable? I've been introduced to him through This Cultural Moment, and he has some incredible insights into secular culture and the future of the church. That is a great suggestion, Mike, but as he's going to be on The Profile, I hope you can listen to that and you'll be able to hear his in-depth conversation with Sam Hales. But maybe at some point we can get Mark Sayers and John Mark Comer on the Unbelievable podcast. That would be fun. I know John Mark Comer has been a long-time listener of the show. A quick look ahead to next week's programme, and we've no regular radio show because we're making space for our regular fundraising appeal on Premier Christian Radio. Do feel free to support us. Unbelievable is very much part of Premier Christian Radio, which is a listener-supported radio station. There's a giving link from the Unbelievable page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In fact, on next week's show, I'm going to be announcing a special gift that we're going to be making available on Giving Tuesday. So look out for that for anyone who gives towards supporting the show. And instead of the regular radio show, we'll make sure there's a podcast with a treat from the back catalogue of Unbelievable, a classic edition from way back when. And so look out for that on next week's edition of the show if you're listening via podcast. And then coming up after that, we'll be having episode 5 of The Big Conversation. Looking forward to releasing this one. Tom Holland, who's a historian, versus A.C. Grayling, the atheist philosopher, on history, Christianity and human value. It's on the back of Tom Holland's new book, Dominion, and A.C. Grayling's new book, which is The History of Philosophy. And they have quite the debate on that about the place of Christianity and what it has done for Western society. So that's coming in about 2 weeks' time. But As I said earlier, you will be able to get it early if you subscribe to the Unbelievable newsletter. We'll be making it available early to anyone who's subscribed. So again, you can do that at thebigconversation.show, or you can subscribe from the Unbelievable show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Quick shout outs to a few new listeners to the show. Matt says, just recently came across the podcast via the Ken Ham and Jeff Swearing debate on YouTube. Now listen to Unbelievable every day. Love apologetics, and it's exciting to hear all the different philosophers, scholars, and even skeptics on the show. Wish I would have found you sooner, because you were in Portland, Oregon, and that's where I live. I recently bought your book, and I'll be reading it after I finish Reasonable Faith by William Lane Craig, who's a hero of mine. And after I finish your book, do you have a recommendation on a good book that deals with the historicity of Jesus? Anyway, thanks for what you do, and your show has blessed me significantly. I would say actually the one that we did just recently on the show, Peter J. Williams' book, Can We Trust the Gospels, is a great, very short actually, but full of information book that might be helpful to you, Matt. Lovely to hear from you. Also had Lawrence get in touch on Twitter, say, recently came across the podcast. I've just finished listening to Tom Wright and James White on Justification from 2013 and have purchased your book on Kindle. Looking forward to reading it. Thank you very much. And you mention here, Lawrence, I didn't know this, that apparently on the Kindle version of my book, Unbelievable, 1,572 passages in the book have been highlighted 34,083 times in the Kindle version. I never realised that there were that many highlights from different people. There you go. Lovely to hear. Lovely words as well from someone who's recently picked up the book. And the book, by the way, if you haven't come across it, is Unbelievable. Why? After 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. This was a review left for the book. Said, several years ago, I left my faith for a skeptical atheism, and it almost tore my family apart. Tom Wright, John Walton, and Justin Briley were instrumental in helping me rebuild my faith stronger than it was before. I'm not in the same place, but I feel I am more rightly dividing the word of truth. Thank you so much. Lovely to hear about new listeners, people who have found the book and found it encouraging. And do feel free to get in touch yourself, of course. If you want to leave me an email, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or get in touch via the Facebook or Twitter, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. That's all for the moment. More of your feedback a little later on in the programme. For now, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's been such an interesting discussion today. Can chemistry crack the mystery of the origin of life? My guests Lee Cronin, Dennis Noble and Perry Marshall have been with me. Lee, before we continue the conversation, where can people go and find out more about your fascinating work?
Just go to croninlab.com.
croninlab.com.
Yeah, just
great.
One word, and there's all the papers and news there and the way to contact me.
Fantastic. I managed to watch a little sort of mini documentary, I think it's a couple of years old, about you and your family and your search for the origin of life. What one bit that amused me was you were all sat around the dinner table or doing some activity with your little kids. They're probably a bit older now. And you asked one of them, where did humans come from? And one of them said, God. And then the other, I think younger one, piped up, no, don't be silly, God doesn't exist. And I thought, I wonder where that's come from. But I mean, this takes us neatly to the question of design. The design hypothesis, you know, you've said, well, look, we need to look at it, at least we can't dismiss it out of hand necessarily.
Sure.
And it sounds like people like James Torr, who, as I say, isn't here to defend himself, but as far as I understand it, he kind of fits with a kind of intelligent design view, that actually you cannot get a naturalistic explanation that does justice to the origin of life. There's too much improbability, too much complexity. You've got to have a kind of input of information right at the beginning. What's your overall reaction to him and to those kinds of theories?
I'll give you one word, nonsense. But let me just unpack it. So James is a really accomplished chemist. He's a great designer. So he loves designing molecules and he's good at it. Where I think James has a problem, and where I think let's take it at face value. There's three possible things that James is trying to do here. Number one, he's just trying to provoke people just to see how they react, which is fair enough. Which I guess he's probably doing, but he clearly doesn't understand information or the mathematics, because the statements he makes are contradictory about complexity and how things emerge. But I think Perry is right about the origin of life, kind of the way it's pitched. But I wouldn't say origin of life is a disingenuous or being dishonest. I think they are not explaining the narrative and what was properly. And they're just building a narrative. And what I find problematical is these people then argue against creationists to say, you're creationist, that's clearly not correct. But yet the origin of life people require so many random things to not be random that you're almost a creationist for the origin of life.
Mm.
So I find these two communities arguing one another, and they're like, and I'm like, guys, you don't understand information theory and the emergence of this. So what I would like to do, and like, Jim is not here to defend himself. Mm. He's a wonderful designer. Mm. Of course he's going to say it's too complicated. But let's look at the experiments that will demystify that and help us give us some information to know whether it's possible to create information. And I think that one thing I would like to pull you and Perry up on is you discussed it and said, well, it's impossible to create information. No, it isn't. That's the point.
Mm.
You're not creating information. You're creating randomness without teleology.
Mm-hmm.
When suddenly that randomness finds a use, it is then trapped and promoted. And that process is the emergence of encoding and decoding. And it's so super exciting, because I think I will be able to convince Perry and Dennis and anyone else who cares that we've got systems that can do that. And more importantly, we can start a wider debate to put the limits on how much have we cheated. Because isn't me having a lab and a robot, that's cheating.
Yeah.
Am I putting information in? That's cheating.
I mean, interestingly with you, Dennis, I've often felt that you have some common cause with the intelligent design community, because both you and the intelligent design folk, the Discovery Institute and so on, have an enemy in the neo-Darwinian kind of explanations. And I know that a number of them turned up to kind of be at, you know, your Royal Society conference.
Indeed,
where you were looking
at
new trends in evolution. Now,
yes.
Now, this, and obviously origins of life all plays into this as well. So do you have any sympathies yourself with that particular way of getting at the issue, the design hypothesis, or do you think it's a dead end as obviously Lee does?
I think it's a dead end for the following reason. It isn't actually useful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't take the view that scientific theories are ever completely proven. They can be disproven. I am a Popperian, just to use the technical philosophical phrase for that. I think we can disprove things. We never completely prove something. In that sense, there's always a bit of mystery to science. We're still asking questions, and we resolve one question, we ask it more questions. Now, the real function of theory in science is to be useful. What experiments would you do because you think this theory is worth testing? That's my touchstone. Mm-hmm. Now, the difficulty with the intelligent design view is I can't see how you'd ever test it.
Right.
I mean, it's really saying, as it were, you'll never do it, and Lee will never do it. Mm. Now, I take the view that the only way to make an advance is to try to do it. Now, I also think that it's true to say that what life does is not just to exist. You used a phrase earlier on, Lee, which was, it's what life does that is important. And I think that's got the point. It is the process. Now, there's something we know about processes. I don't know exactly how Lee's self-replicating salt works, but I suspect there's a bit of a whirlwind there in some way or another that contains the information that keeps the thing going. We see that with weather formations already. That's what the spot on wherever it is, Jupiter or wherever, also tells us. There are things that do naturally arise, and once they arise, and this is the key to them, they then harness the molecules that are in them to continue that process.
But in a sense, it's still chance that gets to that point. But it's not these vast improbabilities you're saying, Lee, that some people paint it as. That you're saying that once you get something that works, it's going to kind of grab onto other things that sort of work.
It's about trapping chance. And what happens in the molecular level is basically lots of things can happen. And so you've just got lots of possibilities and molecules, lots of different states. And what happens when that chance gets trapped, that acts as what we call a template, like a template for an archway. And that can make a really small archway, And that can you can get there randomly, but suddenly you have an ordered structure. All you need is stuff and energy. Now you've got that archway, and stuff and energy, you can make another bigger archway. It makes a template of a template of a template. And before you know it, you've got a complex, self-replicating system that has emerged from no information. And that's what we've just proven, and it's being published right now. You can get it on the archive.
Wow.
And it is the first ever spontaneously arising, I'm going to use a technical word now, called an autocatalytic set. First predicted by Freeman Dyson and Stuart Kaufman. So they're both very excited that this occurs, because the problem with autocatalytic sets today, now the I'll tell you about them quickly for your listeners. An autocatalytic set is a bit like a mutual carpenter. So let's just say you're going to go and buy tables and chairs, and you can't buy a table and chair separately. And what happened is in this case, the table makes the chair, and the chair makes the table. Together, they make each other. Mm-hmm. They don't make each other independently. There's a little bit of assembly. And these are thought to be the first systems that will lead to evolution. But we've only ever seen them in very complicated pieces of nucleic acid, DNA, RNA, or very complicated proteins. And these are way above the information threshold. So once again, you have to be have to have all that information. No one has ever shown the emergence of replicators coupled from randomness. And what we've done is we've used this to generate an entirely new nanotechnology. So suddenly we can make molecules, really small molecules, into a nanotechnology using this salt and understand how it exists to harness it for other devices.
Perry, where you're a Christian, you're the only Christian among the three guests I've got on the show today. Where does this leave you and the God question? Were you always going to be happy if a naturalistic explanation was posited? Do you feel this has any implications for the, I guess, uniqueness of life, if Lee may be correct?
Signature moment in my journey was discovering Barbara McClintock and finding out that a corn plant could edit its own DNA, and finding out that bacteria could chop their DNA into 100,000 pieces and rearrange them. And I suddenly realized that the whole intelligent design argument, the way it's traditionally made, is focusing on the wrong thing, because they're saying, well, you know, God is out there and God did this thing. And as an engineer, I completely understand that argument. But then when I found out that, well, a cell edits its own DNA, it's sort of like an M.C. Escher drawing where a hand is drawing a hand, then it's a whole new ball game. And to me as an engineer, a universe that works that way is way more impressive than a universe where God has to show up and push buttons. Okay. And so I felt like the science was being misrepresented by both the neo-Darwinists and the intelligent design people. In fact, I was kind of astonished that the intelligent design people weren't talking about it, but they weren't. And so I just take that and I wind it back to origin of life. And I say, well, what if that's the same sort of thing? You know, we know that a corn plant can edit its own DNA. What if there are laws of physics that can cause information to emerge? Well, that's a dang impressive universe. And so I still have my sense of wonder and I still believe in God. And you still have to explain where it all came from. Well, but it makes the whole system just that much more impressive.
Perhaps it does in your eyes, Perry, but I suspect for you, Lee, you know, you'll take your Occam's razor to that system and say, well, no need for God. It all explains itself. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not sure me discussing my religious leanings and using that as a way to kind of dismiss others is not productive, because I think what I think Perry is saying quite nicely is, like, he wants to keep his sense of wonder. I have a sense of wonder in the universe, and I happen to not use religion to have it. But, I mean, I would maybe adopt what Carl Sagan say. I mean, maybe in the end, Perry's God is the same as my God, but my God is the physical universe, and I'm just like, wow, look at it unfold. So I do not – lots of scientists don't like the argument with to have the argument with intelligent design, because they feel that their words are going to be somehow misrepresented and put back against them. And I find that problematical, because there are lots of religious people that have beliefs that are very smart, that want to understand how much of those beliefs can be falsified. Mm. So if the belief can't be falsified, so if something can be falsified, I can bring it into my Occam's razor world and away I go. If I can't falsify it, then I am entitled to like believe it and just have a belief system there. But I think that science and religion don't touch in that way. They're mutually compatible. Right. I don't believe that, you know, this is why I get angry about the origin of life people not correctly accounting for the complexity of their molecules and then dissing intelligent design.
Right.
Because they're basically both making a narrative,
okay,
which is not falsifiable.
It's a really interesting way of putting it. Look, it's just been such a fascinating program today. Thank you all for being on. Where might people be able to find out more about your work as well, Dennis? What should people be typing into their search bars in order to find out more about?
Well, the easiest answer is just type Dennis Noble.
Well, that's
into
a good start.
Google, but with one N, not two.
There you go.
There was a two N Dennis Noble who was a very great baritone. Yes. I am not a great baritone.
We don't want to introduce any false information into our intelligently designed searches. Anyway, look. It's been great fun. And of course, Perry, if people want more about Evolution 2.0 and the prize, where can they go for that?
EVO2.org. EVO2.org.
Well, I'll make sure that all three of you have the links as well from today's show. You can find that over at the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. So Lee, Dennis and Perry, thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'd love to know what you thought of our deep dive on the origins of life today. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I do read all the emails. I can't read them all out on air. But you can also get in touch, of course, via the social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And I'm available over on Instagram as well as Justin.Brierley. And I'm going to read out a whole load of responses from Twitter, Facebook and email through a few recent shows. Going to hold off on the responses to the Dave Rubin, John Lennox big conversation until next week's show. So look out for that then. But it was lovely to see this tweet that Lee Cronin put out as he was waiting to record today's show. He tweeted, "With Dennis Noble at Premier Christian Radio, I must admit I only just realised this is a Christian organisation. However, as long as we talk about evidence, the scientific method, it should be fine." And I think it was fine, Lee. Andre, who follows him and me, said, "I'm a mad fan of how Unbelievable approaches this type of stuff. His series with Cosmic Skeptic, who introduced me to Unbelievable, is exceptional. It should be a great stage to share the awe of science and the origin of life." Hope you enjoyed it too, Andre. And speaking of Cosmic Skeptic, a.k.a. Alex O'Connor, who runs the Cosmic Skeptic Atheist YouTube channel, he was in the audience at that debate I had with Rationality Rules at Oxford University. And he tweeted at the time, "Was great to see my two friends, Rationality Rules and Justin, debate Christianity in Oxford. Organised by the Christian Union, Steve was in the lion's den, but commenters on YouTube seem to have reversed that trend. Go show some love." Well, it's true that there was a lot of criticism of my arguments on under Stephen's posting of the video on his YouTube channel. But as you expected, that trend was reversed somewhat when I posted the video on the Unbelievable channel. A lot more sympathetic comments, and especially on Facebook and Twitter as well, actually, and elsewhere. Let me read out some of the lovely things that came in. It was lovely to actually hear from atheists as well as Christians who felt that I did a good job in representing the Christian point of view on that. Jeremy in South Africa, who I'm great friends with now, actually, and he's been listening to Unbelievable for many years as an atheist, and said, "Just watched Is It Rational to Be a Christian? You spoke brilliantly. What a mature and sophisticated and masterfully delivered lecture from you, on par with the best apologists. Excellent presentation. Although I still agree with the materialist position, you put forward a very powerful, deeply thought-provoking and impassioned case for Christianity. I agree with the sentiment expressed by your opponent, as I've mentioned before, that you are my favourite Christian, although I think he meant it in a slightly cheeky sense, perhaps. Thank you very much, Jeremy." So lovely to hear from you, and looking forward to us catching up again at some point. This one from Dylan on Facebook said, "You did a phenomenal job, kept your cool and didn't get bogged down by the side jabs, consistently pushed back on the foundation of things like morality and pushed to get definitions all the way down to their foundations. I was thoroughly impressed. Thank you." And for those who haven't yet heard it or watched it, one of my main arguments against Rationality Rules and the atheist materialist perspective that he represents was that I don't believe you can found reason on the basis of a deterministic materialistic process, and therefore I felt that his very name was, if you like, a paradox in that way. And also morality as well breaks down under such conditions. Luke Ellison says, as an atheist, I think Justin put forth some of the better arguments for theism and Christianity, and they were not at all adequately addressed by Stephen. And Rubin said, Justin did an excellent job, both very respectful. Over on Twitter, Nicholas said, listening to the debate is incredible, Justin. I can't believe I've only known you as a moderator for my journey as a Christian. So awesome, brother. Keep up the good work. Thanks for the show. David says, well done, Justin. Found your presentation relatable and your points convincing. Please continue to accept such requests. Stephen, as usual, raised points worthy of thought and investigation, and I appreciate his willingness to enter the lion's den. Titus said, I finally listened to Unbelievable thoroughly defeat rationality rules. Good work, Justin. Thank you very much, Titus. Jeff says, Justin, think you did a terrific job as the protagonist, just as I appreciate the civil way that you more regularly serve as moderator. Your exchange, in part, increased my belief in the existence of Australia. You'll have to listen to the debate to understand that reference. Lawrence says, haven't watched it, but did download and listen. Truthfully, haven't listened to many debates, but what I heard today, I thoroughly enjoyed, especially the questions asked and answered. It has encouraged me to listen to more. And Sean said, Justin, this one was good, but that girl's question at the end made me think of a great podcast. Is Christianity arrived at through privilege? By the way, literally in our philosophy class that day, we were talking about everything you guys talked about when it comes to determinism. Here's some more from the Facebook page that came in. Rebecca says, great debate. It did seem, however, like Stephen hasn't truly investigated Christianity or the Bible for himself, but has merely adopted atheistic views. His arguments were flat. Callum Muzz didn't like it. He's an atheist commenter at the Facebook page. Says, you were okay, but your arguments are still fallacious, mainly falling into special pleading, God of the gaps, or just what you hope to be true. Then there's your take on rationality, which just doesn't make any sense. Sorry, but it's not more rational to be a Christian, says Callum. Paul says rationality ruled and was clearly on the side of Christianity. Well done, Justin. And Dan says, always a pleasure to see you as a debater instead of a moderator. I'm often taken aback when you present some of your views, which is a testament to your neutrality and professionalism when you're moderating. Now, I think Dan is another atheist contributor over at the Facebook page for Unbelievable. And you said, Dan, I know these types of exchanges are not always best viewed in terms of winners and losers, but you won this one, hands down. Although, strictly speaking, I think the actual question wasn't properly addressed. It wasn't, is Christianity rational, but rather, is it rational to be a Christian? Even as an atheist, I would certainly say yes to that. And Greg Newfield said, I thought you did an amazing job presenting the Christian worldview as more rational than a naturalistic / atheistic one. And Daniel Joseph said, it's always fun to see the tables turned, especially as Justin is an adept public speaker. While I understand that in a debate, the purpose is to provide a better overall argument than your opponent on the given topic, it's always disappointing when the topics one finds most important aren't covered in depth as one would like. What stood out to me most was what I thought were the disappointments from both sides. Justin mainly repeated a lot of apologetical arguments that are bad as arguments either for theism or Christianity in particular, like the moral argument. A lot of Justin's case sounded more like a cover sheet of the basics of already basic and sometimes unsound arguments. But for Stephen, there are arguably more positions one can take on any matter as an atheist as opposed to theist. As such, it's more likely as an atheist that my particular views will not be shared by popular speakers, and it was no different here. Stephen's strong point is not moral philosophy, and he represents a minor secular view of morality to which theism has more strength against it. I can't wait for actual experts in secular morality to debate theists. Thank you very much for those thoughts. And Carl said, just a quick note to say well done on the conversation with Stephen. Thought you did a great job of being generous and patient and firm, tackling head-on Stephen's objections. I was disappointed with Stephen's completely opposite approach to the debate. He seemed dogmatically opposed to any generosity towards Christianity and frequently resorted to straw man arguments, which you did well to point out. The low point was definitely his analogy of playing chess against a pigeon. If anything, this described exactly his behaviour on the evening. Thank you you very much, Carl. And a couple more here just to finish us off. An email from Sam in Newcastle says, listener of the podcast Unbelievable for around 8 years now, first time writing in, and the reason is I wanted to give you some feedback on the debate with rationality rules. Can I say I've had much admiration for the way you moderate the show, always fair, and make sure both sides of the argument are heard, and make sure you try your best to stay as impartial as possible. So forgive me when I say that I expected much of the same restraint in this debate with you versus rationality rules. To my amazement and joy, I feel as though you delivered time after time with precision and confidence, rational and solid arguments that, in my opinion, clipped the wings of rationality rules. Rationality rules had quite a bit of confidence to begin with, until he showed quite simply that his own worldview was irrational, and if true, not that truth exists in his own view, falls under its own weight. How can he claim to be rational or his position true if his argument and view of reality was determined by random chance? A quote from John Lennox sprung to mind at this point. So you believe that your mind was the end product of a mindless, unguided process? And you trust it? I also loved the part where you said that the very notion of morality that rationality rules was using to judge God in the Old Testament was a construct of 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian beliefs, which, if rationality rules considered for a moment, he'd rethink his opening statement that Christianity was poison. There were 1,000 other things I could mention you did so well on, but I have things to do. Just wanted to write in and say bravo. Thank you, Sam. And finally, Jeff in Fort Collins, Colorado, says, recently had the pleasure of listening to that debate on whether it's rational to be a Christian. Can't say how much I appreciated your well-thought-out arguments, kind and respectful demeanour. Well done indeed. Love the show. Thank you. So many lovely, lovely, lovely comments following that debate in Oxford. If you haven't yet watched it, it's available over on our YouTube channel, also on the Unbelievable podcast, and Rationality Rules himself has a very popular YouTube channel as well, where it was also shared. Let's go back though a bit further to the consciousness show between Sharon Dirks and Philip Goff. We were debating particularly panpsychism on that edition of the show. Fabulously interesting program, I thought. This from Eric, who's one of my favorite emailers out in the US. Writes great emails, does Eric. Another fantastic discussion. Shows like these make Unbelievable the best Christian radio program on the air. Ask NT Wright Anything is a close second. I had the pleasure of listening to it with my son on a road trip across the state of Washington. We found ourselves pausing it frequently in order to discuss the many interesting ideas the guests put forward. I read Sharon's excellent book several months ago, and I just started reading Philip's book today. Philip succinctly stated the problem when he said that we've become so familiar with our own consciousness that we neglect the fact it's such a profound mystery. I appreciated that both Sharon and Philip were on the same page when it came to the inability of scientists to explain the immaterial realm with materialist explanations. I was fascinated by Philip's thesis that the origin of the science-faith conflict was a misunderstanding of the work of Galileo. Philip made the case that Galileo acknowledged both a quantifiable physical realm that could be studied with science and a qualitative immaterial realm that was no less real but inaccessible with scientific methods. Philip also mentioned in his book that Galileo declared that maths was the language of science. I found this interesting because it doesn't neatly separate the material and immaterial realm, like he may have hoped, since mathematics itself is immaterial. In addition, Sharon pointed out the problem of the placebo effect. As a physician, I rely on a gold standard for scientific studies, which requires them to be double-blind and placebo-controlled. So it appears that the best science has to offer must control for the effects of the immaterial mind on the physical brain. If mind doesn't exist, then placebo control is unnecessary. Philip's description of the immaterial realm as one dominated by qualities reminded me of how people describe near-death experiences. They describe a heaven dominated by vivid, indescribable colours and sounds that defy physical description. Is a NDE, a near-death experience, in fact, an encounter with the mind of God? It's an interesting question. They both agreed that the immaterial realm looked a lot like consciousness, but diverged on the source of that consciousness. Philip seemed content to leave consciousness as a brute fact, governed by a set of universal psychophysical laws, much like gravity. Sharon tried to push him to consider that the source may just be a personal mind, but he didn't seem to think that a personal source added anything to his idea, despite the fact that the three individual consciousnesses in the Unbelievable studio discussing the topic of consciousness just happened to be persons. Apparently, it's acceptable to discuss the consciousness of persons, but not the personal consciousness of the universe. Seems to me that one of the defining characteristics of consciousness is that it is personal. So when you cut God out of the picture, it tells me that you're no longer talking about true consciousness. Some more to your email here, Eric, but I'll leave it there. Love, great, really interesting insights there. Always enjoy hearing your thoughts, and glad that you're listening with your son on your road trips to Unbelievable as well. Quite a number of other ones there to the consciousness debate. Let me just get a couple more in. Micah in Portland, Oregon says, there was what seemed to me a big hole in that conversation as it touched on materialism, dualism and panpsychism, but it never brought up idealism, which posits that all of reality is consciousness, except for one mention of the word by Philip with no real explanation of what that option entails. The person to have on the show to discuss this, who's a serious thinker, computer scientist, philosopher, would I think be Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, who has been published in various scientific journals with articles from an idealist perspective. Would be fascinated to hear someone who's a Christian idealist slash dualist converse with him on this type of consciousness and how it relates to questions of God, if that might ever work out. Thanks, Micah. Yeah, and of course, we did have, of course, a well-known Christian idealist in the form of Keith Ward on The Big Conversation last year, debating materialist Dan Dennett. So if you haven't checked that one out, do go and look it up. I think you'll enjoy it. And finally, this one from John in Victoria, Australia said, we not only have consciousness, but we have creative consciousness. I love classical music, and some of it, for example, Mozart's Ave Verum Corpus, I find so painfully beautiful that I can't believe it's the product of animated stardust. It is a subjective argument, but very real for me, and reflects the belief that we are created in the image of God. There are more here on that consciousness debate between Sharon Dirks and Philip Goff, but we'll leave them for another time. Just finish off with a few of your comments on that big conversation we had between Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams on Jesus and the Gospels. Lots of tweets on that. Here's some of them. The Apostate, a pastor C on Twitter, says, I'm typically not a fan of these kinds of live debates and discussions because so many points are missed and very little is actually illuminated. But this was one of the better ones. Still frustrating at times, but still worth the listen. Kaspar said, I've listened to the debate two times, found it quite fascinating, both debate partners eloquent and their differences clearly laid out. This tweet from Curtis Ferrell said, Bart Ehrman was well prepared, articulate and gracious. However, the argument he made about Judas's demise was at its core a black swan argument. If we've never seen it, it hasn't happened. The bias appeared again when he said Jesus probably said these things, but he didn't say those things. It seems he readily embraces the sceptical positions as fact while firmly rejecting the possibility an opposing view has any credibility. And of course, that debate about the way that Judas died in Acts versus Matthew was, of course, a supposed contradiction that Bart brought up, and that there's been quite a lot of talk about online since. Alan says, firstly, I'd like to thank you and the team for the show. During my daily dog walk, while talking to God about how much I enjoyed that last show with Peter and Bart and Peter's follow-up message about Judas, a thought struck me and I realized I needed to write it to you. How interesting would a show be between the two atheists, Bart and Richard Carrier, a mythicist versus a believer in the historical Jesus? Yes, Alan, that would be fun, wouldn't it? I know that Bart has done on-stage discussions with other mythicists, like Bob Price, for instance. So I don't know if he'd be up for a Richard Carrier one at some point. And you also mentioned the very good Twitter thread by Peter J. Williams on the supposed contradiction on Judas's death, which was very helpful. Tim in Newby, Oklahoma says, how do we know that Judas hung himself by the neck with a noose, as we commonly assume? What is Bart Ehrman's evidence for how that happened? There's no mention of a rope in Matthew or Acts. Could it be he impaled himself, which was a form of hanging at the time? That would explain both falling headlong and his bowels gushing out. This one from Cheeto said, I felt stuck smack bang in the middle between the two of them. On the one hand, I'm not an inerrantist, and William's argument from external confirmation of Luke Acts wasn't strong. I'm with Ehrman there. Luckily, the evidence of Luke Acts can reach a much stronger conclusion. The external confirmation in Acts, explicit claim to be an eyewitness in parts of Acts and travelling with Paul, as well as the corroboration with Paul's epistles, all combined to show he was indeed who he said he was. In the we narratives, Luke mentions staying with Philip and Manasseh, both early Christian converts. Couple that with Paul himself having spoken with Peter and James, plus the fact Luke was in and around Jerusalem when Paul was in prison, and it shows Luke had multiple valuable sources and good opportunities to find out more. That's all a historian could ask for. And Dave in Boone, North Carolina, also finds himself stuck somewhere in the middle, says, I'm a person who believes in the authority of Scripture, though I don't subscribe to an inerrant view where the Bible's infallible. I do think that Ehrman won the debate from my perspective. What I took away from his argument was two things. One was that the Scriptures are unlikely true because of oral tradition, but if the authors were speaking directly to eyewitnesses, would that qualify as oral tradition, or would that qualify as writing down eyewitness accounts? This seems an important question, and obviously one that relates to a large body of scholarship on oral tradition. So I'm interested to know more about this concept of oral tradition and if it applies to New Testament studies. Certainly John's Gospel would have been a direct first-hand account regardless. The second Ehrman argument seemed to be that Scriptures are unlikely true because of the contradictions. Well, this seems to really only be a problem for the fundamentalist view of Scripture as being infallible. If you take the view that human beings actually wrote down the things that they were eyewitnesses of, then there's a much smaller problem with stories contradicting themselves. The story of Judas, for example, may have been the recollection of two different people about the same event. Doesn't mean the event didn't happen, it just means that small details may be remembered differently. This seems to be bare true in human experience when our memories recall significant events the same as others, but the peripheral details may stick out differently in our minds. I believe N.T. Wright has written about this. David says, I'm a new listener to the Unbelievable podcast, thoroughly enjoying the variety of subjects. The most recent conversation between Peter and Bart, I thought Bart provided some nice pushback against Peter's argument on the authority of the gospel writers. His example of contradiction in relation to Judas's death, though, was at best weak and at worst completely inconsequential, since Judas hanging himself doesn't exclude the possibility of Judas falling down in the field or vice versa. Bart's making the weak assumption that Judas falling headlong into the field was being specific to the event of his death rather than considering that it happened after he hanged himself. I also noticed Bart gave various opinions that supposedly weren't really his opinions, which seemed like a convenient way of escaping a sticky position he got himself into. Anyway, very interesting to listen to. Sounded like you had a much easier time moderating this discussion with all participants giving each other plenty of room to articulate their points, as opposed to that conversation between Steve Chalk and Phil Moore. I liken that conversation to the NASCAR Indy 500, where each participant was fighting to lead the other around in circles. Entertaining, but not much going on. This one from Matt on Facebook, again, wants to get in on this death of Judas issue. Says, in an odd way, anytime I hear Bart speak, it actually strengthens my faith in the integrity of Scripture, because the points of contention he bring up force me to inspect and research the subject myself. And in every case, Bart's complaint quickly falls apart. Take the subject that was causing Bart such consternation, the suicide of Judas. A quick word study shows that the Greek word Luke used was prenes, far as I can tell, pronounced pre-nesi. It's only used once in the entire New Testament and not widely used in Greek literature. When it is used in the wider Greek literature, it's most often taken to mean leaning forward or face down. I think there's even more evidence it's to be understood this way, because when the word head is used to mean a part of an anatomy, the New Testament writers use the word kephale, used 75 times, as opposed to pre-nesi, which is used only once. So to say head first is a bit misleading. When understood this way, the story harmonizes quite well. Judas hangs himself, the rope breaks, the body, probably post-mortem bloated, falls face down, and his bowels gushed out, as the ESV states. There's even a book written in the late 19th century about the unique medical language found in Luke and Acts, and prenesi is one of those words. Come on, Bart, if an amateur like me can dismantle your arguments with about 30 minutes of research, surely you can do better. I admit he's a very skilled debater, and in every debate I've seen, he begins by machine-gunning examples to overwhelm the other person. But when you take the time to pick apart each example, they simply don't hold up, and every time I'm more convinced the Gospels can be trusted. Thank you very much. Thanks to all those who've been in touch. Going to leave the voluminous number of responses to that particular show there. Just to say thanks to Micah Green, who got in touch via Twitter after that one, and also says he loves the questions and discussions. And you just watched the Atkins-Lennox debate, have just recently discovered the show. Good to have you on board, Micah. Appreciate you coming along. And if you're a new listener to Unbelievable, perhaps you've joined us because of the big conversation, finding us online via the YouTube channel or some other way, great to have you on board for the podcast. This is the place where you get weekly conversations that matter, and it's great to have you with me. I've been Justin Brierley. Thank you for listening to today's edition of the show. The Profile is here next with Mark Sayers, but let me tell you what's coming up on the programme next week. You're unbelievable. The usual radio show is making way for our regular fundraising appeal on Premier Christian Radio. And if you would like to support the work of Premier Christian Radio and indeed Unbelievable, please do consider giving to that. You can find a link to give to Unbelievable specifically from the show page at premierchristianradio.com. But we do have something going out on the podcast for all the podcast listeners. It'll be a best of from the archive of Unbelievable. And we'll be telling you about how your gift could help you get your hands on the content from the Unbelievable Conference USA as well. So listen out for more about that. For the moment, thanks for being with me on today's show, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.